We picked George up from Bywater Street and walked him along the South Bank for his health. It was a summer's evening. He was always moaning that he didn't get enough exercise. And out of this evening's stroll beside the river, Operation Windfall was born. Oh, for Christ's sake, grow up. Oh, I'm grown up, don't worry. And you're getting younger by the minute. How did the conversation go? I'm all ears. We talked treachery. In the large, not in detail, there was no point. Anyone who was a present or recent member of Joint was suspect by definition. So 50, 60 people, all potential traitors within. We talked about who had the right sort of access to blow Jackknife, but we knew that with Bill running Joint and Percy Allerline eating out of his hand and Bland and Esterhaz getting in on the act in any way they could, all that any traitor had to do was show up at Joint's free-for-all planning sessions or sit around the senior officer's bar and listen to Percy Allerline sounding off. Bill always said compartmentation was a bore. Let's have everybody knowing everything. That gave him all the cover he needed. How did Smiley respond to your day, Marsh? He'd do some hard thinking and get back to us, which is as much as anyone ever got out of George. Look here, I think I'll take that coffee you offer me, if you don't mind. Black, no sugar. I stretched, shook my head, yawned. I'm of an age, for God's sake. But Bunny wasn't buying, and Laura had given up on me long ago. They were eyeing me like a couple of people who'd had about enough of me, and coffee was off the menu. Bunny had put on his legal face. No more squeezing of the eyes, no more raising the voice for a slow-witted older man who doesn't hear too well. I want to go back to where we came in. That all right with you? You and the rule of law. The service and the rule of law. Do I have your full attention? I suppose so. I mentioned to you the British public's insatiable interest in historic crime, something by no means lost on our gallant parliamentarians. Did you? Probably. Or the law courts. The historic blame game, that is, the current rage, our new national sport. Today's blameless generation versus your guilty one. Who will atone for our father's sins, even if they weren't sins at the time? But you're not a father, are you? Whereas your file rather suggests you should be overrun by grandchildren. I thought you said my file had been filleted. Are you now telling me it hasn't? I'm trying to read your emotions. I can't. You either have none, or you have too many. You go lightly over Liz Gold's death. Why, you go lightly over Alec Lemus's death. You pretend total amnesia about Windfall, whereas we know perfectly well that you were Windfall cleared. Significantly, your late friend Alec Lemus was not so cleared, despite the fact that he died in harness to an operation he wasn't cleared for. I'm not asking you to interrupt, so kindly don't. However, he went on, forgiving me my ill manners, I do begin to discern the outlines of a deal between us. You admitted that Operation Windfall might ring a distant bell for you. Possibly a training exercise, you said graciously and idiotically. So how's this? In exchange for greater transparency on our side, might the distant chimes of that bell get a little clearer on yours? I ponder, shake my head, try to capture those distant chimes. I have a sense of fighting to the last man. And the last man is me. The way I think I dimly remember it, Bunny, I concede, signalling a slight change of direction in his favour. Windfall, if it comes back to me at all, wasn't an operation. It was a source. A dud one. I think that's where we've been misunderstanding each other. Hoping for some sort of easing from the other side of the table and not getting any. A potential source who fell flat on his back at the first fence and was promptly and very sensibly dumped, file and forget. I plunge on. Source Windfall was a relic from George's past, another historic case, if you like. Deferential nod to Laura. an East German professor of Baroque literature at Weimar University, a pal of George's from the war years who'd done a bit of this and that for us. He got in touch with George through some Swedish academic or other back in 59 or so. Keep it flowing, keep it imprecise, a golden rule. The prof, as we called him, claimed to have red-hot news about a super-secret compact being struck between the two halves of Germany and the Kremlin, said he'd heard all about it from some like-minded pal in the East German administration. It's really tripping off the tongue by now, just like old times. The two halves of Germany were to be reunited on condition they remained neutral and disarmed. In other words, exactly what the West didn't want. A power vacuum bang in the centre of Europe. If the circus would just spirit the prof to the west, he would give us chapter and verse. Rueful smile, shake of the old white head, and nothing coming back to me across the big divide. Turned out all the prof wanted for himself was a chair at Oxford, a job for life, a knighthood, and tea with the Queen. Chuckle. And of course he'd made the whole thing up, pure bollocks. Case closed. I ended. Feeling it was a job well done, nonetheless, and Smiley, wherever he was, would be silently applauding. But Bunny was not applauding. Neither was Laura. Bunny looked insincerely worried, Laura plain incredulous. "You see, the problem is, Peter," Bunny explained after a while, "what you've just pitched us is exactly the same tired bullshit that we're getting from the dummy files on Windfall in the old Central Archive. Am I right, Laura?" Evidently he was, because she came in bang on cue. "Practically word for word, Bunny. Concocted with the sole purpose of leading any nosy inquirer up the garden path. No such professor ever existed, and the story is total fabrication from start to finish. And I mean all fair and good if Windfall had to be protected from the prying eyes of the Haydens of this world. A dummy file for smoke in the Central Archive makes good sense. What doesn't make sense, however, Peter, is that you sit here at your great age trying to sell us the same shitload of disinformation that you and George Smiley and the rest of Covert were putting out a generation ago," Bunny said, and managed a half squeeze of the eyes for friendly. "We found the reigning control's old financial returns, you see, Pete," Laura explained helpfully, while I'm still considering my reply. "For his reptile fund. That's the slice of the secret vote that control gets for his personal pocket money, but it still has to be accounted down to the last penny, right, Peter? As to a child. Hand-submitted by the man himself to his trusted ally at Treasury. Oliver Lacon, his name was, later Sir Oliver, now the late Lord Lacon of Ascot West." "Do you mind telling me what all this has got to do with me?" "Everything, actually," Laura said calmly. "In his financial returns to Treasury, Lacon's eyes only, Control gives the names of two circus officers who, if requested, will provide full and frank disclosure regarding the costs pertaining to a certain Operation Windfall. That's in case the extra expenditure should ever be challenged by posterity. Control was very high-minded in such regards, whatever else he wasn't. Name one was George Smiley. Name two was Peter Gwillem. You." For a while, Bunny seemed not to have heard anything of this exchange. He was head down again, eyes below the parapet, and whatever he was reading required his full attention. Eventually he emerged. "Tell him about the Windfall safe flat you've unearthed, Laura. Covert's shady nook where Peter stashed all the files he stole," he suggested in a tone to imply he was busy with other matters. "Yes, well, there's this safe flat that's mentioned in the accounts, like Bunny says," Laura explained obligingly. "And a safe flat housekeeper, what's more," indignantly, "and a mysterious gentleman called Mendel, who isn't even on the services books, but has been hired by Covert exclusively on an agent basis for Windfall. 200 quid a month to his post office savings account in Weybridge, plus travel and exes up to another 200, accountable, paid out of an unnamed client account run by a she city law firm, and one George Smiley with effective power of attorney over the account in its entirety." "Mendel being who?" Bunny inquired. "Retired police officer, special branch," I replied, by now on autopilot. First name Oliver, not to be confused with Oliver Laken. Acquired how and where? George and Mendel went way back. George had worked with him on an earlier case, liked the cut of his jib, liked it that he wasn't circus. My breath of clean air, he called him. Bunny was suddenly exhausted by the whole discussion. He'd flopped back in his chair and was flapping his wrists around, easing his body on a long flight. So let's just get real for a change, can we? He suggested with an implicit yawn. Control's Reptile Fund is at this exact point or moment in time the sole exclusive piece of credible evidence that provides us with A, a path to the conduct and purpose of Operation Windfall, and B, a means to defend ourselves in any frivolous civil action or private prosecution brought against this service and against you, Peter Gwilym, personally, by one Christoph Limas, sole heir of the late Alec, and one Karen Gold, spinster, sole daughter of the late Elizabeth or Liz. Did you hear any of that? You did. Don't say we've surprised you at last. Still slumped in his chair, he admitted a low Jesus while he waited for my reaction. And probably it was a long time coming, because I also have a memory of him bellowing an imperious "Well?" at me. Liz Gold had a child, I hear myself ask. A feisty edition of herself on present showing. She had just turned 15 when she was knocked up by some oaf at her local grammar. On her parents' insistence, she gave the baby into adoption. Somebody christened it Karen, or maybe not christened, she's Jewish. Having grown to woman's estate, the said Karen exercised her legal right to know the identity of her natural parent and became understandably curious about the place and manner of her mother's death. He paused in case I had a question. Belatedly, I had. Where the hell did Christoph and Karen get our names from? He ignored it. Karen was much encouraged in her quest for truth and reconciliation by Christoph, son of Alec, who, ever since the wall came down, had, unknown to her, been busting a gut to find out how and why his father had died. Not, I have to say, with the enthusiastic assistance of this service, which has gone out of its way to put every fucking obstacle in their path that we could think of, and then some. Unfortunately, our best efforts have proved counterproductive, despite the fact that the said Christoph Limas has a German police record as long as your arm. Another pause, and still no question from me. The two plaintiffs have now bonded. They have convinced themselves, not without reason, that their respective parents died as a consequence of what appears to have been a 5-star cock-up by this service and by you and by George Smiley personally. They are seeking full disclosure, punitive damages, and a public apology that will name names. Yours for one. Were you aware that Alec Limas had engendered a son? Yes. Where's Smiley? Why isn't he here instead of me? So do you happen to know who was the fortunate mother? The German woman he met in the war when he was operating behind the lines. She later married a Dusseldorf lawyer called Eberhardt. Eberhardt adopted the boy. His name isn't Limas, it's Eberhardt. I asked you where George is. Later. And thank you for your excellent powers of recall. Were other people aware of the boy's existence? Your friend Limas's other colleagues? We'd know, except his file's been stolen, you see. And already sick of waiting for my answer. Was it or was it not generally known in and around this service that Alec Limas had sired a German bastard named Christoph, resident in Dusseldorf, yes or no? No. How the fuck not? Alec didn't talk a lot about himself. Except to you, apparently. Did you meet him? Who? Christoph. Not Alec. Christoph. I think you're back into being deliberately obtuse. I've been nothing of the kind, and the answer's no, I did not meet Christoph Limas, I retorted. Because why spoil him with the truth? And while he's still digesting this, I asked you where Smiley is, and I ignored the question, as you may have noticed. A pause while we both waited to collect ourselves and Laura stared moodily out of the window. Christoph, as we may call him, Bunny resumed in a lethargic tone, is not without his talents. Peter, criminal or semi-criminal though they may be. Perhaps the genes help. Having confirmed that his natural father died at the Berlin Wall on the eastern side, he wangled his way, by what means we know not but respect, into a stash of supposedly sealed Stasi archives and came up with three significant names, yours, the late Elizabeth Gold's, and George Smiley's. Within weeks, he was on the scent of Elizabeth, thence by way of public records to her daughter. A tryst was arranged, the unlikely pair bonded, to what extent, not ours to pry. Together they consulted one of those admirably high-minded civil rights lawyers with open-toed sandals who are the bane of this service. We, in response, are considering offering the plaintiffs a fortune of public money in exchange for their silence, but are only too aware that in doing so we confirm to them that they have a decent case and thus encourage them to become even more strident than they are at present. To hell with your money, you men of evil. History must be allowed to speak. The canker must be cut out. Heads must roll. Yours for one, I fear. And George's too, presumably. We are therefore faced with the ludicrous Shakespearean premise whereby the ghosts of two victims of a fiendish circus plot rise up to accuse us in the form of their offspring. Thus far, we have managed to contain the media by implying, not entirely truthfully, but who's counting, that in the event of Parliament stepping aside to make way for the legal process, the case will be heard in the decent seclusion of a secret court, and we alone will decide who gets the tickets. The plaintiffs, in response, egged on as ever by their thoroughly annoying lawyers, are saying, screw that, we want openness, we want full disclosure. You asked, somewhat ingenuously, where the Stasi could have got your names from. Why, from Moscow Center, of course, who duly passed them on to the Stasi. Where did Moscow Center get your names from? From this service, of course, thanks yet again to the ever-diligent Bill Hayden, at that time very much at large and destined to remain so for another 6 years, until St. George rode up on his white horse and smoked him out. Are you still in touch? With George? With George? No. Where is he? And have not been over recent years? No. So your last communication with him was when? 8 years ago. 10. Describe. I was in London. I looked him up. Where? In Bywater Street. Where was he? Fine, thank you. We seek him here, we seek him there. The wayward Lady Anne, you're not in touch with her either? Touch, strictly in the metaphorical sense, naturally. No, and I don't need the innuendo either. Well, I need your passport. What for? The same one that you presented at reception downstairs, please, your UK passport. Hand outstretched above the parapet. Why on earth? I gave it to him anyway. What else was I supposed to do, fight him for it? Is this all of them? Mulling thoughtfully through the pages. You've had a scad load of passports in your time under various guises. Where are they all now? Turned in, shredded. You have dual nationality. Where's your French passport? I was born to a British father. I served as a Brit. Brit's good enough for me. Now can I have my passport back, please? But it had already disappeared beneath the parapet. So, Laura, you again, said Bunny, rediscovering her. Can we now go a little deeper into that windfall safe flap, please? It's over. I've fought to the last lie. I'm dead. And I'm out of ammunition. Laura once more examines papers below my eyeline, and I do my best to ignore the beads of sweat rolling down my ribcage. Yes, well, safe flat, and how, Bunny, she agrees as her head comes up again in relish. A dedicated safe flat for sole use of Windfall, and that's just about the entire job description. to be situate within the purlieus of inner London, plus a statement that the said flat will be known for cover purposes as the stables, and a permanent housekeeper to be assigned at Smiley's discretion, and that's about our lot. Ring a bell after all? Bunny inquires. They wait. So do I. Laura resumes her private conversation with Bunny. It's like Control didn't even want Lakin to know where the place was, or who looked after it, Bunny, which, given Lakin's seat of power at the Treasury and his comprehensive knowledge of other areas of circus business, strikes me as a touch paranoid on Control's part, but who are we to criticise? Who indeed? Stables as in sweep them clean? Bunny asks, all curiosity. I assume so, she says. Smiley's choice? Ask Pete, she suggests helpfully. But Pete, which I detest, has gone even more deaf than he pretends to be. And the good news is, Bunny to Laura again, that there still is a windfall safe flat, because either by design or sheer neglect, I suspect the latter, the stables has remained on the private imprest of no fewer than 4 successive Controls. And it's there now. And our very own top floor doesn't even know it exists, let alone where it is. Funnier still, in these times of austerity, its existence hasn't been questioned by the dear old Treasury. They've nodded it through, bless them, year after year. He affects a homophobe lisp. Too secret to ask, darlings. Sign along the dotted line and not a word to Mummy. It's leasehold, and we have not the faintest idea when the lease expires, or who holds it, or what generous arsehole pays the bills. And to me, on the same savage note, Peter, Pierre, Pete, you're very quiet. Enlighten us, please. Who is that generous arsehole? When you're cornered, when you've tried all the tricks in your locker and they haven't worked, there aren't many ways left to wriggle. You can spin the story within the story. I'd done that and it hadn't worked. You can try a partial hangout and hope it ends there. I'd done that too, but it hadn't ended there. So you accept that you've reached the end of the road and that the only option left to you is be bold, tell the truth, or as little as you can get away with, and earn a few brownie points for being a good boy. None of which struck me as a very likely outcome, but it might at least get me my passport back. George had a tame lawyer, I said, as the sinful relief of confession rose in me despite myself. The one you call Shishi, a distant relative of Anne's. He or she agreed to play cutout. It's not a safe flat. It's a safe house, 3 floors high. And it was leased by an offshore trust registered in the Dutch Antilles. Spoken like a hero. Bunny's approval. And the safe house keeper? Millie McCraig, a former agent of George's. She'd kept for him before, had all the skills. When Windfall started up, she was keeping a circus safe house for Joint in the New Forest, place called Camp 4. George told her to resign, then reapply to Covert. He transferred her to the Reptile Fund and set her up in the stables. Which is situate where, may we now know? Still Bunny. So I told them that too, complete with the stable's phone number, which tripped off my tongue as lightly as if it had been straining to come out all along. Then there was stage business while Bunny and Laura made themselves a gully through the files on the table between us, and Bunny plonked a broad-bottomed telephone of a complexity that was totally beyond me in the gap, and, having touched a succession of keys at lightning speed, handed me the receiver. At a tenth of Bunny's speed, I touched in the stable's phone number and was startled to hear the dialing tone blaring out all over the room, which wasn't just grossly insecure to my guilty ear, but an act of outright betrayal, as if I'd been blown, captured, and turned in a single move. The phone bawled out its ringing tone. We waited, still no answer, and I was thinking either Millie's at church, because she used to do a lot of that, or she's out bicycling, or she's a sight less agile than she used to be, like the rest of us. But more likely she's dead and buried, because beautiful and unattainable though she was, she had a good 5 years on me. The ringing stopped. There was a rustle, and I assumed the call was going over to answer phone. Then, to my astonishment and disbelief, I heard Millie's voice, the same sore edge of puritanical Scottish disapproval that I would mimic to make George laugh when he was feeling low. "Yes, hello?" And when I hesitated, "Who is that, please?" Indignantly, as if it was midnight rather than 7 in the evening. "It's me, Peter Weston, Millie," I said. And throwing in Smiley's cover name for good measure, "friend of Mr. Barraclough's, if you remember." I was expecting, even hoping, that for once in her life Millie McCraig would need time to collect herself, but she came back so sharply that it was I, not she, who was disconcerted. "Mr. Weston?" "Himself, Millie, not his shadow." "Kindly identify yourself, Mr. Weston." Identify myself? Hadn't I just given her 2 cover names? Then I realized she wants my pinpoint, which was a form of obscure coded communication more often used over Moscow's telephone system than London's, but Smiley in our darkest days had insisted on it. So I grabbed a brown wooden pencil that was lying on the desk in front of me and, feeling a total idiot, stooped over Bunny's super-elaborate telephone and tapped my 1,000-year-old pinpoint code onto the speaker, hoping it would have the same effect as if I'd tapped it onto the mouthpiece. 3 taps, pause. 1 tap, pause, 2 taps. And evidently it did, because no sooner had I delivered the last tap than Millie was back, all sweet and accommodating, saying it was nice to hear my voice after all these years, Mr. Weston, and what could she be doing to help me at all? To which I might have replied, "Well, since you ask, Millie, could you kindly confirm that these events are playing out in the real world and not in some murky corner of the middle world reserved for the unsleeping spies of yesterday?" 4. On my arrival from Brittany the previous morning, I'd booked myself into a dismal hotel near Charing Cross Station and forked out £90 in advance for a room the size of a hearse. On my way there, I'd also paid a courtesy call on my old friend and former Joe, Bernie Lavender, gentleman's tailor to the diplomatic corps, whose cutting rooms were situated in a minuscule semi-basement off Savile Row. But size had never mattered to Bernie. What had mattered to him, and to the circus, was getting inside the diplomatic parlours of Kensington Palace Gardens and St. John's Wood, and doing his bit for England, with a modest tax-free income on the side. We embraced, he drew the blind and dropped the latch on the door. For old time's sake, I tried on a couple of his uncollecteds, jackets and suits made for foreign diplomats who, for unknown reasons, had failed to collect them. And finally, also in the spirit of old times, I entrusted him with a sealed envelope to pop in his safe until my return. It contained my French passport, but if it had contained the plans for the D-Day landings, Bernie couldn't have treated it with greater reverence. Now I've come to reclaim it. "And how's Mr. Smiley, then?" he asks, dropping his voice out of reverence or an exaggerated sense of security. "Have we heard of him at all? Mr. G?" "We haven't. Has Bernie?" Alas, Bernie hasn't either. So we make do with a chuckle about George's habit of disappearing for long periods without explaining himself. But inside I wasn't chuckling. Was it possible George was dead? And that Bunny knew he was dead and wasn't telling? But not even George could die in secret. And how about Anne, his ever-faithless wife? Word had reached me a while back that, tiring of her many adventures, she had espoused a fashionable charity. But whether the attachment had endured any longer than its predecessors was anybody's guess. With my French passport back in my pocket, I took myself to Tottenham Court Road and invested in a couple of disposable mobile phones with £10 worth of phone time apiece. And as an afterthought, the bottle of scotch I'd neglected to buy at Rennes Airport, which probably accounts for the merciful fact that I have no memory of the night that somehow passed. Rising with the dawn, I walked for an hour through drizzle and ate a bad breakfast in a sandwich bar. Only then, with a sense of resignation tinged with disbelief, did I pluck up the courage to hail a black cab and give the driver the address that for 2 years had been the scene of more rejoicing, stress, and human anguish than any other place in my life. As I remembered it, number 13 Disraeli Street, alias the Stables, had been a shabby, unrestored Victorian end-of-terrace house in a Bloomsbury side street. And to my astonishment, that is the house that stands before me now, unchanged, unrepentant, a standing reproach to its shiny, prinked-up neighbours. The time is 9 a.m, the appointed hour. But the doorstep has been commandeered by a slender woman in jeans, sneakers and leather jacket, who is talking vituperatively into her mobile phone. I'm about to begin another circuit when I realize she is Laura, who is history in modern dress. "Sleep well, Pete." Like an angel. Which bell do I press without catching gangrene? Try ethics. Ethics being Smiley's own choice for the least alluring doorbell he could think of. The front door swung open, and there in the half-darkness stood the ghost of Millie McCraig. Her once jet-black hair was as white as mine, her athlete's body bent with age, but the same zealous light burning in the moist blue eyes as she allowed me one air kiss on each frugal Celtic cheek. Laura brushed past us into the hall. The two women squared up to each other like boxers before the fight, while I underwent such turbulent feelings of recognition and remorse that my one desire was to steal back into the street, close the door after me, and pretend I'd never been here. What I was seeing around me would have surpassed the dreams of the most demanding archaeologist. A scrupulously preserved burial chamber, its seals unbroken, dedicated to Operation Windfall and all who had sailed in her, complete with every original artifact from my pizza delivery gear hanging from its hook to Millie McCraig's upright lady's bicycle, a vintage model even in its day, with wicker basket, tingling bell and Rexine carrier bag parked on its stand in the hallway. "Will you be wishing to look around at all?" Millie is saying to Laura as indifferently as if she is talking to a potential purchaser. "There's a back door," says Laura to Millie, producing an architect's plan of the building, and where in God's name had she got that from? We stand at the glazed kitchen door, below us a handkerchief-sized garden, and at its centre, Millie's vegetable patch. Oliver Mendel and I gave it its first dig. The washing line bare, but Millie was expecting us. The birdhouse, the same one. Mendel and I had cobbled it together one midnight out of bits of spare timber. Mendel, under my slightly drunken guidance, had embellished it with a pokerwork plaque declaring no bird turned away, and there it stood, as proud and upright as on the birthday it had celebrated. A stone path weaves between the vegetable beds to the kissing gate that leads to the private car park that leads to the side street. No safe house George countenanced was complete without a rear entrance. "Anybody ever come in that way?" Laura inquires. "Control," I reply, sparing Millie the need to answer. "Wouldn't have come in the front door to save his life." "And the rest of you?" "Use the front door." Once Control had decided the back way was his, it became his private lift. "Be generous in small things," I'm advising myself. "Keep the rest in your memory locked and throw away the key." Next on her itinerary is the winding wooden staircase, a miniature replica of every dingy staircase at the circus. We're about to ascend it when, to the tinkle of a small bell, a cat appears, a large, black, long-haired, malign-looking animal with a red collar. It sits, yawns, and stares at us. Laura stares back at it, then turns to Millie. "Is she on the budget, too?"
"She's a he, and I pay for him myself, thank you."
"Does he have a name?"
"Yes."
"But it's classified?"
"Yes."
With Laura striding ahead and the cat cautiously following, We ascend to the half-landing and come to a halt before the green baize door with its combination lock. Beyond it lies the cipher room. When George first took the place, the door was glazed, but Ben the cipher clerk wouldn't allow his fingers to be watched, hence the baize. Right, who's got the combination? Laura in scout mistress mode. Since Millie again says nothing, I reluctantly recite the combination. 21-10-05, the date of the Battle of Trafalgar. Ben was Royal Navy, I explain, but if Laura understands the reference, she gives no sign of it. Parking herself in the swivel chair, she glowers at the array of dials and switches. Flips a switch. Nothing. Turns a dial. Nothing. Power has been off ever since, Millie murmurs to me, not to Laura. Swinging round in Ben's chair, Laura jabs a finger at a green chub wall safe. Right, has that thing got a key? The rights are getting on my nerves. They're like Pete. From a bunch at her side, Millie selects a key. The lock turns, the safe door swings open. Laura peers in and, with a scything movement of her arm, sweeps the contents onto the coconut matting. Codebooks blazoned top secret and beyond. Pencils, reinforced envelopes. Faded one-time pads in cellophane packs of 12. We leave everything as it is, right? She announces, swinging back to us. Nobody touches anything anywhere. Got that, Pete? Millie? She is midway up the next flight of stairs when Millie, with an excuse me, stops her in her tracks. Would that be my personal quarters you're proposing to enter at all? And if I am? You're welcome to make an inspection of my apartment and personal possessions, provided I have advance notice in writing and in good time signed by the appropriate authority at head office, Millie pronounces in a single, unmodulated sentence, which I suspect she's been rehearsing. In the meantime, I'll trouble you to respect my personal privacy as becomes my age and station. To which Laura comes back with a heresy that not even Oliver Mendel would have risked on a good day. Why's that, Mill? You got someone tucked away up there? The classified cat has removed itself. We stand in the middle room, so-called from the day Mendel and I cleared away the old hardboard partitions. Look at it from the street, all you got was another dingy, net-curtained ground-floor window. But on the inside there was no window, because one snow-swept Saturday afternoon in February we bricked it up, consigning the room to eternal darkness until you switched on the green-shaded gambler's lights we bought from a shop in Soho. Two cumbersome Victorian desks filled the centre, the one Smiley's, the other, but only occasionally, Control's. Their origin had remained a mystery until an evening when Smiley revealed to us over a scotch that a cousin of Anne's was selling off a country pile in Devon to pay death duties. What in the name of all that's holy is that hideous thing when it's at home? Laura's eye has lighted, not to my surprise, on the garish 3-foot by 2-foot wall chart hanging behind Control's desk. Hideous? Not to my eyes, but life-threatening, yes indeed. Before I knew it, I had grabbed the ash walking stick hanging over the back of Control's chair and embarked on an explanation designed not to enlighten, but divert. This section here, Laura, waving the stick at a maze of coloured lines and cover names resembling a crazy London underground map, is a homemade representation of the circus's East European network, codenamed Mayflower, as it stood before Operation Windfall was conceived. Here we have the great man himself, Source Mayflower, the network's inspiration, founder, cutout and hub. Here his subsources, and here, in descending order, their subsources, conscious or otherwise, together with a capsule description of their product, its rating in the Whitehall marketplace, and our own in-house assessment of the sources and subsources' reliability on a scale of 1 to 10. With which I hung the stick back on its chair. But Laura didn't appear quite as diverted or confused as I would have wished. She was examining the chart's cover names one by one, checking them off. Behind me, Millie is sidling from the room. Well, now we do know a couple of things about Operation Mayflower as it happens, Laura remarked in a superior tone. From the odd file you were kind enough to leave behind in the general archive, plus a couple of other sources of our own. And having let this sink in, What's with naming everybody after garden plants, anyway? Ah, well, that's from the days when we used themes, Laura, I replied, maintaining as best I could the lofty tone. Mayflower, so flowers, not the ship. But again I'd lost her. What the hell are these stars for? Sparks, Laura, not stars. Figurative sparks. In cases where field agents have been issued with radio sets. Red for active, yellow for cached. Cached? Buried. In oilskins, usually. If I hide something, I hide it, right? She informs me, still hunting among the cover names. I don't cache. I don't do spy speak, and I'm not in a boys' club. What are these plus signs, anyway? Stabbing her fingertip at the bubble around a subsource and keeping it there. They're not plus signs, actually, Laura. They're crosses. You mean they're doubles? They've been double-crossed. I mean they're extinct. How? Blown. Resigned. A raft of reasons. What happened to this man? Codename Violet? Yeah, what happened to Violet? Was she closing in on me? I was beginning to suspect she was. Missing, believed interrogated. Based East Berlin, 1956 to 1961. Ran a team of train watchers. It's all in the bubble. Meaning, read it for yourself. And this fellow, Tulip? Tulip's a woman. And the hashtag? Has she been waiting all this time for her fingertip to land where it is now? The hashtag, as you call it, is a symbol. I think I got that. What of? Tulip was a Russian Orthodox convert, so they gave her a Russian Orthodox cross. My voice steady as she goes. Who did? The women? The two senior secretaries who worked here. Did every agent who had religion get a cross? Tulip's orthodoxy was part of her motivation to work for us. The cross marked that. What happened to her? Disappeared from our screens, alas. You didn't have screens. Our assumption was that she'd decided to call it a day. Some Joes do that. Break off contact and disappear. Her actual name was Gamp, right? Like Umbrella, Doris Gamp? This is absolutely not a wave of nausea I'm feeling. That was not any kind of lurch of the stomach. Probably Gamp. Yes, I think it was. I'm surprised you know. Maybe you didn't steal enough files. Was it a big loss? Was what? Her decision to call it a day. I'm not sure she announced her decision, just ceased to operate. Still, yes, over time it was a loss. Tulip was a major source, substantial, yes. Too much, too little, too light. She's thinking about it for too long. I thought it was windfall you were interested in, I remind her. Oh, we're interested in all of it. Windfall's just an excuse. What happened to Millie? Millie? Ah, Millie, not Tulip, Millie. When? I say stupidly. Just now, where did she go? Upstairs to her flat, probably. Would you mind whistling for her, please? She hates me. But when I open the door, there's Millie waiting with her keys. Pushing past her, Laura strides ahead down the corridor, map in hand. I hang back. Where's George? I murmur to Millie. She shakes her head. Don't know or don't ask. Keys, Millie. Millie dutifully unlocks the double doors to the library. Laura takes a pace forward, then slapstick style two back as she admits the mandatory cry of holy shit. So shrill it must have awakened the dead in the British Museum. Incredulously, she advances on the ranks of tattered tomes that cram the bookshelves from floor to ceiling. Gingerly she makes her first selection. Volume 18 of a broken 30-book set of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, published 1878. She opens it, flips a couple of pages in disbelief, dumps it on a side table and treats herself instead to Treks Through Araby and Beyond, published 1908, also part of a broken set, and priced, as I unaccountably remember, at 5 shillings and 6 pence a volume, £1 for the lot, after Mendel had beaten down the dealer. Do you mind telling me who reads this crap, or did? To me again. Anyone who was windfall cleared and had good reason.
Meaning what?
Meaning, I reply with as much dignity as I can muster, that George Smiley was of the opinion that since we were not blessed with an armed fortress beside the Thames, natural concealment was better than physical protection. And that while barred windows and a steel safe would act as an open invitation to any local footpad to break and enter, the thief had yet to be born whose ideal heist was a skipload of, "Just show me, okay, whatever you stole, whatever's here." Placing a set of library steps in front of a fireplace filled with Millie's dried flowers, I fish from the top shelf a copy of A Layman's Guide to the Science of Phrenology by Henry J. Ramkin, M.A. Cantab, and from its gouged cavity, a buff folder. Passing the folder down to Laura, I restore Dr. Ramkin to his shelf and descend to firm ground to find her perched on the arm of a library chair scrutinizing her bounty, and Millie again nowhere to be seen. "I have a Paul here," Laura says accusingly. "Who's Paul when he's at home?" This time I'm not quite so successful at controlling my tonal responses. "He's not at home, Laura, he's dead. Powell, pronounced the German way, was one of several cover names that Alec Limas used in Berlin for his Joes." Belatedly I managed the casual. "He alternated. Didn't trust the world much. Well, didn't trust joint steering, let's say." "She's interested, but doesn't want me to know it." "And these are all the files, right? The whole caboose. Everything you stole is right here, hidden in these old books, yes?" I'm only too pleased to enlighten her. "Not all, by any means, Laura, I'm afraid. George's policy was to keep as little as possible. Whatever could be dispensed with was shredded. We shredded, then we burned the shreds. George's law." "Where's the shredder?" "Right over there in the corner." She'd missed it. "Where did you burn them? In that fireplace?" "Did you keep destruction certificates?" "Then we'd have had to destroy the destruction certificates, wouldn't we?" While I am still relishing my little victory, her gaze shifts to the darkest and most distant corner of the room where two long photographs of standing men hang side by side. And this time she emits no cry of "holy shit" or any other exclamation, but advances on them in slow steps as if afraid they'll fly away. "And these beauties? Joseph Fiedler and Hans-Dieter Mundt, respectively head and deputy head of the Stasi's operational directorate. I'll take the one on the left. That's Fiedler. Description? German-Jewish, sole surviving son of academic parents who died in the camps. Studied humanities in Moscow and Leipzig. Late entrant to the Stasi, fast-streamed, smart, hates the guts of the man standing next to him. Mundt. By a process of elimination, yes, Mundt, I agree. First name, Hans-Dieter. Hans-Dieter Mundt in a double-breasted suit with all his jacket buttons done up. Hans-Dieter Mundt with his murderer's arms pressed to his sides, thumbs downward, staring contemptuously into camera. He's attending an execution, his own, someone else's. Either way, his expression will never change. The knife slash down the side of his face will never heal. He was your mark, right? The man your pal Alec Limas was sent to eliminate, right? Except Mundt eliminated Limas instead, right? She returns to Fiedler. And Fiedler was your super source, right? The ultimate secret volunteer. The walk-in who never walked in. Just dumped a pile of red-hot intelligence on your doorstep, pressed the bell and ran away without leaving his name, over and over, and you still don't know for sure he was your Joe, as you call him, that right? I take a breath. All the unsolicited windfall material that we received pointed in Fiedler's direction, I reply, picking my words with precision. We even asked ourselves whether Fiedler was positioning himself to defect and, so to speak, casting his bread on the waters in advance. Because he hated Mundt so much? Mundt, the ex-Nazi who never quite reformed? That would have been a motive, combined, we assumed, with a disillusionment about the democracy or lack of it as practiced by the German Democratic Republic, the GDR. The feeling that his communist god might have failed him, turning to certainty. There'd been an unsuccessful counter-revolution in Hungary, which the Soviets had repressed rather brutally. Thank you, I think I knew that. Of course she did. She's history. Two disheveled youths were standing in the doorway, one male, one female. My first thought was that they must have come in by the back entrance, which had no bell, and my second, a wild one, I admit, that they were Karen, daughter to Elizabeth, and her fellow plaintiff Christoph, son to Alec, come to make a citizen's arrest. Laura gives herself a lift up on the stepladder for extra authority. Nelson, Pepsi, say hello to Pete, she commands. Hi, Pete. Hi, Pete. Hi. Okay, listen up, everyone. The premises where you are standing will henceforth be treated as a crime scene. They are also circus premises. That includes the garden, every bit of paper, file, piece of detritus, whatever's on the wall by way of charts, pegboards, whatever's in the drawers and bookshelves is circus property and potentially a court exhibit to be copied, photographed and listed accordingly, right? Nobody says it isn't right. Pete here is our reader. For his reading, Pete will be accommodated here in the library. Pete will read. He will be briefed and debriefed by head of legal and myself. Only. Back to the disheveled youths. Your conversations with Pete will be social, right? They will be courteous. They will not at any point touch on the material he is reading or the reasons why he is reading it. All of which you both know, but I'm repeating it for Pete's information. Should either one of you have cause to suppose that Pete or Millie, by mistake or deliberately, is attempting to remove documents or exhibits from circus premises, you will immediately notify legal. Millie? No answer, but she's still in the doorway. Was your area, your apartment, ever used, is it now used, for any kind of service business? Not that I'm aware of. Does your area contain service equipment, cameras, listening devices, secret writing materials, files, papers, official correspondence? It does not. Typewriter? My own, purchased by myself out of my personal money. Electronic? Remington manual. Radio? A wireless, my own, purchased by myself. Tape recorder? Further wireless, purchased by myself. Computer, iPad, smartphone? Just a normal telephone, thank you. Millie, you've just had your advance notice. Written confirmation is in the post. Pepsi, you will please accompany Millie to her apartment now, right? Millie, please provide whatever assistance Pepsi requires. I want the place picked into small pieces. Pete? Laura? How do I identify the active volumes in these shelves? All quarto books on the top shelves with authors' names beginning A to R should contain papers if they haven't been destroyed. Nelson, you remain here in the library till the team arrives. Millie? What now? The bicycle in the hallway. Kindly move it. It's in the way. Seated in the middle room, Laura and I are alone for the first time. She has offered me controls chair. I prefer Smiley's. She appropriates controls for herself, lounging on her flank, either for her relaxation or for my benefit. I'm a lawyer, right? A pretty fucking good one. First I went private, then I went corporate, then I got pissed off and applied to join your crowd. I was young and beautiful, so they gave me history. I've been history ever since. Whenever the past threatens to bite the service in the arse, it's get Laura. And Windfall, believe me, is looking like quite some bite. You must be very pleased. If she notices the irony in my voice, she ignores it. And what we want from you, corny as it may sound, is the whole truth and nothing but, and screw your loyalty to Smiley or anybody else, right? Not right at all, so why bother to say it? Once we have the truth, we'll know how to doctor it, maybe in your favor too, where our interests coincide. My job is to head off the shit before it hits the fan. That's what you want too, right? No scandals, however historic. They're a distraction. They raise unpleasant comparisons with our own times. A service marches on its reputation and its good looks. Rendition, torture,
Playing footsie in the woodshed with murderous psychopaths, it's bad for the public image, bad for trade. So we're on the same side, right? Again, I managed to say nothing. So here's the bad news. It's not just the offspring of the windfall victims who are after our blood. Bunny was soft-peddling out of kindness. There's a bunch of attention-hungry MPs who want to use windfall as an example of what happens when the surveillance society is allowed to run amok. They can't get their hands on the real stuff, so give them history. And growing impatient at my silence. I'm telling you, Pete, if we don't have your total cooperation, this thing could... She waits for me to complete the sentence. I let her do the waiting instead. And you really haven't heard from him, right? She says finally. It takes me a moment to realize I'm sitting in his chair. No, Laura. Once again, I've not heard from George Smiley. She leans back and hauls an envelope from her back pocket. For a mad moment, I think it's going to be from George. Electronically printed. No watermark. No human hand. Temporary accommodation has been obtained for you effective today's date at apartment 110B, Hood House, Dolphin Square, London, SW. Following conditions apply. I am to keep no pets. No unauthorized third party to be admitted to the premises. I am to be present and available in the premises between 2200 hours and 0700 hours, or supply legal department with notification in advance. In view of my position, unstated, a concessionary rental of £50 per night will be set against my pension. There will be no charge for heat, light or electricity, but I will be held accountable for any loss or damage to property. The disheveled youth called Nelson is poking his head round the door. Van's up, Laura. The sacking of the stables is about to begin. 5. Dusk was falling. An autumn evening, but by English standards warm as summer. Somehow my first day in the stables had ended. I walked for a while. Had a scotch in a pub full of deafening young, took a bus to Pimlico, hopped out a few stops early and walked again. Soon the lighted hulk of Dolphin Square was rising at me out of the haze. Ever since I had rallied to the secret flag, the place had given me the shivers. Dolphin Square in my day had more safe flats to the cubic foot than any building on the planet. And there wasn't one of them where I hadn't briefed or debriefed some luckless Joe. It was also the place where Alec Lemus had spent his last night in England as a guest of Moscow's recruiter before setting out on the journey that killed him. Flat 110B, Hood House, did nothing to dispel his ghost. Circus safe flats had always been models of planned discomfort. This one was a classic of the breed. One industrial-sized fire extinguisher, red, two lumpy armchairs with springs gone, one reproduction watercolour of Lake Windermere, one minibar locked, one printed warning not to smoke even with window open, one very large television set that I automatically assumed was two-way, and one mossy black telephone with no number on it to be used, as far as I was concerned, for disinformation purposes only. And in the tiny bedroom, one iron-hard school bed, single, to discourage venery. Closing the bedroom door on the television set, I unpacked my overnight bag and cast around for somewhere to cash my French passport. A framed instructions in case of fire was badly screwed to the bathroom door. Easing the screws, I slid the passport into the cavity, tightened them again, went downstairs and devoured a hamburger. Back in the flat, I treated myself to a liberal shot of scotch and tried to recline in an austerity armchair. But barely had I drifted off than I was awake again and cold sober. This time in West Berlin, in the year of our Lord, 1957. It's a Friday. End of day. I've been in the divided city a week, and I'm looking forward to a couple of carnal days and nights in the company of a Swedish journalist called Dagmar,
with whom I have fallen passionately in love in the space of 3 minutes at a cocktail party given by our British High Commissioner, who doubles as British Ambassador to the eternally provisional West German government in Bonn. I'm due to meet her in a couple of hours, but before doing so, I've decided to drop in on our Berlin station and say my hellos and goodbyes to my old pal, Alec. Down at Berlin's Olympic Stadium, in an echoing red brick barracks built for Hitler's glory and once known as the House of German Sports, the station is packing up for the weekend. I find Alec standing in the queue at the